Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Lib Dem blogger Mark Thompson, and also regularly featuring my co-host and podcasting partner, Emma Burnell, who blogs at the Labour Scarlet Standard blog. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hello. Probably a slightly shorter one than normal tonight because, for various reasons, I've got to cut it slightly shorter. But there's a couple of topics we thought we wanted to discuss this week. So, first of all, Emma, the scandal that's involved three peers and also one member of parliament in the last few days, where there are allegations that they were willing to accept money in return for lobbying on behalf of a company that actually didn't exist because it was part of a sting operation by a newspaper. What are your thoughts about the fallout from this?
Well, I mean, it's a terrible scandal again. These seem to happen at least once a year, and everyone goes, something must be done, and then nothing is done once again. And it takes a government of the most extreme cynicism to go, right, we've got a problem with a private what was thought to be a private sector lobbying firm. Let's go after the unions. I mean, it's just the most astonishingly nasty, cynical, anti-politics move that could have possibly come. And it's frankly a disgrace. It's trying to deal with a problem that the Conservatives and Lib Dems have with the way Labour is funded, rather than the problem, which is across the board. And several times these lobbying scandals have been Labour MPs. I am not claiming that Labour don't have a problem with the lobbying issue, but it's not the issue of union funding. And it is astonishingly cynical to do it this way.
Okay, maybe I've slightly missed something here because I think I understand the link you're talking about, but can you just fill in the gap there? What is it in response to this story? Has the government started talking about Labour funding?
Absolutely. The new lobbying and transparency bill that they've announced today will cover any organisation, so not individual, who gives over £100,000 to a political party. So that basically means all the unions
All right,
and nobody else.
okay, so I think what that probably demonstrates is actually what the reason why this hasn't happened so far, because whenever you try and draw up rules for this, they start to fall into the pattern of the whole unintended consequence thing, don't they? So, well,
You
I
think there's
say,
unintended
I, okay, all
consequences?
right, I say unintended. Now, there, I'm not naive enough to think that there aren't some people in some political parties who would want to cut off the funding for Labour, but I think it does actually demonstrate that when you do try and draw these rules up, that there are all kinds of consequences of them. I mean, I read a piece today that was talking about basically what is a lobbyist, who lobbies, and the argument was pretty much everyone who has anything to do with government at all lobbies, and pretty much any company of any size lobbies, and all charities lobby.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how do you draw up these rules to say who can lobby and who can't, and who needs to be registered and I'm not saying it's not possible to do, and I personally don't want to see a situation where the Labour funding stream is cut off as a result of this. And so I suspect that what will happen is that yet again, this will fall by the wayside because Labour will be opposed to it, and I suspect there'll be enough in the other parties who don't think it's fair to do this that it will fall apart again. And what we need is a solution to this, not more party politicking. So I have to say I'm quite despondent to hear what you've just said.
Yeah, I mean, it is just stupid. It's, you have a problem. There are solutions that have been mooted to this particular problem, up to and including things in the coalition agreement on transparency, on lobbyist register. I don't think we need to stop anyone lobbying. I think that's anti-democratic. I think what we need to do is have transparency about who lobbies when and who.
Yeah.
And that's quite a different matter than saying you can't lobby. There is a revolving door issue, and I think there does need to be something put into civil service and MP ministerial contracts that says you cannot go and work for an industry that lobbied you for X amount of time, because there are real issues with the influence that that might have on government decisions.
Absolutely. And
But
actually,
none of this is to do with, I mean, there are, people who have problems with the way the Labour Party is funded, but they're not the same problems as people who the problems that we have with the way that lobbying works.
Yeah, I mean, that point that you just made about people in government taking decisions with one eye on what, you know, directorships and you know, deals they might have after they leave office. And I have to say that I did think in Tony Blair's later years that there were things that he was saying and doing, or perhaps more significantly, things he wasn't saying, that must have been influenced, even if only on a subconscious level, by what he thought he might be doing when he left office. And I found that very uncomfortable. And I almost felt like, you know, a yearning for the days of, you know, many years ago when it was that sort of thing would just not have been the done thing. The idea that politicians now leave office and the first thing they do within a couple of weeks is they take up several directorships. And when you look, coincidentally, someone who was health secretary and defence secretary and, you know, I don't know, a couple of other secretaries suddenly has directorships that are related to all the portfolios that they held whilst they were in office. That, I find that pretty disturbing. Having said that, as a good liberal, I'm not inclined to say that that should be banned. But at the same time, I think there needs to be more scrutiny put on that and maybe some kind of, like you say, time limit on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. A part of the problem is politicians are getting younger. So yeah. If you're prime minister in your 40s and then you stop being prime minister after X amount of time, then you'll still have a large expanse of your life left once you've finished being prime minister or senior minister or senior government minister or whatever. So, you know, what do you do with that time other than go to work for someone else?
You're right. It's a difficult one. And I mean, you know, I do wish that we had more older politicians in senior roles, really. I think we'd be better as a nation for it. Again, I don't know what the answer is because, you know, the fact that the three leaders of the three main political parties in Parliament at the moment are all in their 40s. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's unprecedented in terms of, you know, if you look back 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, leaders of political parties were usually quite significantly older. And I think, I mean, I don't know why we've ended up in this sort of situation. I think when Tony Blair came in 1994, that was seen as quite unusual, wasn't it? That he was a kind of young, seemingly fairly dynamic politician. Then, obviously, when he won, William Hague, who was even younger than Tony Blair, came in to be leader of the Tories. And when eventually Cameron came in, I think he was seen as a kind of new broom, wasn't he? Mm. And in terms of Clegg, I mean, Charles Kennedy was obviously pretty young as well. So I suppose this has been happening for quite a while. But I think you're right that you can't reasonably expect a politician who's been prime minister or in that very high political office, who's still in their 40s or early 50s when they lose office, to suddenly not do anything. They have to do stuff. And it is inevitable that they're going to do stuff in the private sector to earn quite a lot of money. Because let's be honest, a lot of these people probably feel that, you know, they missed out and their contemporaries who they went to university and all the rest with have earned loads of money in their 30s and 40s, whereas they've been in Parliament. And although compared to an average person, they've earned quite a lot of money, compared to their contemporaries, they won't feel like they've earned that much money. And they probably think now it's my turn to earn the big bucks and, you know, get the directorships for the next 10 or 20 years. So, like I say, I don't think you can stop it, but there definitely needs to be more scrutiny on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And just stricter rules, you know, that make sense, that stop there being a sense that government can be bought. And that's the problem. And you don't fix the sense that government can be bought by going after the opposition's funding stream. It feels really, really nastily anti-democratic to me. Really, really anti-democratic.
Well, like I say, I don't think this is going to fly. I don't think it will get through. And I hope that some compromise on this can be found, because we need something done about lobbying, and we need it done sensibly. I'm tempted to say, I mean, I know in last week's podcast, we were talking about how you don't make good law in a knee-jerk response to, you know, a difficult situation that's happened. You know, that was in the context of, you know, the terrorism that we were talking about last week. I mean, I'm tempted to say the same sort of thing applies here, that the government shouldn't be rushing out legislation the next day or, you know, 2 or 3 days later after the Sunday papers, or, you know, I'm not even sure if the Panorama programme's even aired yet that's had these allegations. They do need to, you know, be contemplative about it and take their time. But, you know, they've had 3 years. They should have been doing this work in the background. And I fear that that's not been happening and that now it is a knee-jerk response and that they haven't thought it through. So, you know, if they need to take a bit of time to get it right, take the time, but then do it. I really don't want to find that another year goes past and then we're in the run-up to the next election and this just completely falls by the wayside, because that's what I fear will happen if they don't get it right this time.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm more cynical that they'll manage to get it through. I think that's enough. Tories and Lib Dems will vote for it and it will go through, because at the end of the day they don't want well-funded opponents, and that's a nasty, nasty, nasty way of looking at it. And I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think I am.
I hope you're wrong too, and maybe we'll revisit this in future podcasts when we get a bit more detail on if that's likely to happen, and you know what the consequences of that would be. And another angle on this which I wanted to talk about is in the case of the MP that's been accused of this, Patrick Mercer. So what he's been accused of offering to take money to represent a company that was to do with Fiji, I think.
Yes.
I actually had a look at the company's, the company, let's put it in quotes because it didn't exist, the company's website. And it looked incredibly professional. I thought they'd done a very good job on it.
Yes.
I'm not surprised that they were taking it out. I've recently been watching a lot of...
Is that better than the website of the lobbying firm I used to work on?
Well, yeah.
That website.
That was the thing, what it reminded me of. I've been watching a lot of old episodes of Hustle. I don't know if you remember that programme that was on... a few years ago, it was about a bunch of con artists.
Yes, I never watched it, but...
Well, every time that they were putting a sting into operation and they were trying to convince the mark of their bona fides, they had this character called Ash Three Socks Morgan, who would always set up websites and put in a kind of Google history trail and stuff to make it look like they were genuine, whatever they were conning. And they always looked really good, these web... The idea that one person, a con artist, could throw this all together and do all the hack, it always seemed very far-fetched, but it's very entertaining. And it just kind of reminded me of that they've really thought about this and they've put it together. But to come to the more serious point, it does appear that Patrick Mercer was taken in by this. Although, like I say, I don't think the program's aired yet, and there is an investigation going on. But if it turns out that what is alleged is actually the case, and then the fact that he has resigned the Conservative whip and he's announced that he's going to stand down at the next general election suggests that there's certainly something going on, do you think it's right that he's able to still sit in Parliament for another 2 years? Turns out that this is correct.
Yeah, if it turns out that it's correct, no, there should be that power of recall that we were promised and has not happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just yet again. Power of recall was fine when you're in opposition and are playing the MP's expenses scandal story very, very well. Actually, when you get into government and you don't have a strong majority, you've had to go into coalition, the idea that one of your MPs might be recalled is really, really frightening. And you quickly lose your impetus on that particular bit of legislation.
Mm. Well, I wrote a piece for the Independent Online Indie Voices today, actually, about this, because I was sitting there last night and I was thinking about it, and it really reminded me of what happened during the expenses scandal. Because my local MP of the time, Andrew Mackay, was heavily caught up in the expenses scandal. Between him and his wife, who was also a Tory MP, Julie Kirkbride, they had done something on the claiming of the housing allowance, the second homes allowance, I think, where they were, it was something like...
Can I just apologise for the music in the background, the ice cream van's coming round?
I was going to say, it's making me hungry. I haven't had my dinner yet. It was something to do with that they were claiming each other's houses as their second homes. And basically, it was definitely not right. And they admitted it and they paid back the money. But Andrew Mackay held a public meeting in our constituency. And it was very well attended. There were 200 or 300 people in this big hall. And it was just an extraordinary thing. This was in May 2009. So it was just after it had all come out. And he was fighting for his political life. And it was... You know, it was actually quite heartrending to see. I mean, the audience was overwhelmingly against him, and he was getting shouted down. There was, you know, he was accused of being a thief. At one point, someone shouted he was a thieving toad. It was pretty horrible to see. I mean, I'm not saying he didn't deserve criticism. I think he did, but it was clear he was fighting for his political life. And then afterwards, I felt slightly less sorry for him because he came out and he tried to spin to the media that the majority of the meeting were with him, which was a load of rubbish. And actually, three people had taken film cameras in and filmed it, and it was released to the media. And by 6 o'clock the next day, next evening, he'd announced he was not going to stand for election at the next general election. But we were still a year away from the next general election at that point. He hung around as our MP for another year. We could do nothing about that. We couldn't get rid of him. We had no rights about that. And yet it was pretty clear that the vast majority of his constituents were disgusted with his behaviour. You know, I mean, I was one of them, and okay, I'm a Lib Dem, so you'd expect me to say that. But there were people in the audience who were clearly, in fact, I know they were members of his constituency party. A couple of people who spoke self-identified as members of his constituency party, and they were disgusted with him as well. I'm sure they wanted him to stand down. And you know, round about that time, there was all this talk about recall, and I know it was around about that time that Douglas Carswell and Daniel Hannan wrote a book called The Plan, which I actually interviewed Douglas Carswell about. That Douglas Carswell's a Tory MP, for those who don't know, and Daniel Hannan's a Tory MEP, and I think they consider themselves to be on the kind of radical right, and they have all these ideas about, you know, direct democracy, and one of the things that they were really keen on was this idea of recall. They also somehow seem to think that open primaries are going to solve everything as well. I'm far less convinced about that. I don't think recall would solve everything either, but yeah, I don't understand why this government hasn't implemented something. I think there probably are logistical problems, and I think there are concerns about, you know, vexatious campaigns got up to try and get rid of MPs for reasons that aren't really legitimate in quotes. But the compromise that I've heard that was being talked about, and still, like I say, hasn't been implemented, was that there would have to be a committee of MPs who would decide whether or not an MP could be recalled. Now, that's just putting the power slap bang in the heart of the establishment again. Whereas what we need is, you know, if this is going to happen at all, we need it to be able to be an initiative from the constituents themselves. You know, if there has to be a threshold of 5% or 10% or whatever it is, fair enough. And I think it has to be high enough that you can't just have someone with a bit of a grievance going around a few of his mates and getting a petition up, and then, you know, otherwise we'd be having by-elections every week. We'd be having dozens of by-elections every week, and it'd be pointless. But we can't just have nothing. The idea that if Patrick Mercer is guilty of this, that he can stay in Parliament and his constituents in Newark have got to put up with him for another 2 years, and there's nothing they can do. And let's be honest, the fact that we now have fixed parliaments makes this even more important. Because at least in previous parliaments, you might have thought, well, you know, 3 or 4 years and there'll be a general election, you know, in terms of the length of the parliament. And if you're 2 or 3 years in, you might think it's probably only another year or 6 months. Well, now we're pretty certain this parliament's going to run until May 2015. So it's even more important that there are mechanisms in place to deal with errant MPs.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I've been talking about during a number of the things that have happened over the last year. So, for example, with Eric Joyce and with the Lord Rennard allegations, is having a civil service department that acts like an HR department for Parliament. And I think that might help in this. So, if, for example, a apolitical, non-aligned group of people like IPSA, but for HR issues, decided that somebody had, you know, committed what in a workplace would be gross misconduct, then they could say this person mustn't needs to be recalled.
But that isn't that still giving the power to the establishment? I think the idea that you have constituents who can get a petition together, and if they get enough signatures, and like I say, threshold would have to be quite high, but if it was, say, 10%, so typically 8,000 signatures of constituents, then that would trigger a by-election, and then you wouldn't need you know, a department within Parliament deciding whether or not recall can happen.
I'm uncomfortable with, I think it would be too easy, particularly in a constituency where half the vote goes to one party and the other half goes to another party, which are quite a few constituencies. I think it'd be really, really easy, even with a very high threshold, just to say, "Oh, go on, it's a laugh, let's get him out." And it would just be constant, and nobody would. I think you need to be able to pursue long-term projects as an MP. And I think that would be, if we found that we were just constantly fighting in our constituencies rather than in Parliament, I think it would unbalance the way MPs work to too much.
So do you, because when we started this discussion, you were again quite coruscating about the government and the fact that it's yet again not done something. But do you not think that maybe that's why the government hasn't done something? Because it's too difficult to find a
It's
mechanism
possible. I
that
mean, I
couldn't
think
be
there should
abused?
be some form of power of either recall or sacking MPs between elections. Everybody else in the world gets sacked if they do something that's considered gross misconduct. And there has to be a way of doing that. Now, the way of doing that could be my way, it could be your way, but there should be something. And post expenses scandal, yet another lobbying scandal. It's just, how many scandals is it going to take for us actually to move on this?
Well, I mean, I wrote this in my piece today that I think the most depressing part of this is that I mean, I don't do it so much now, but during the expenses scandal, I did find myself over and over again talking to friends and family, most of whom don't give a flying toss about politics, but all of whom were very angry about what they were hearing and reading. Where I was trying to explain to them and persuade them that the vast majority of MPs and politicians are not in it for what they can get out of it, but are in it because they genuinely feel like they can do good. And I mean, you know lots of politicians, Emma, and you must see this firsthand all the time. That
Absolutely.
most of them, of all parties,
Absolutely.
are
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
in it for the
They
right
may have
reasons.
misguided ideas about how to do good,
Yeah.
but that's what they're there trying to do.
Yeah, but the motives are good, generally.
Yeah.
And yet, when you see scandals like this, and these are the things that get all the coverage, it just adds grist to the mill of the people who say they're all the same, they're all in it for what they can get, they're all corrupt, they're all bastards. And, that's why we need something like this, so that there is a focus and a conduit for those feelings, and so that people don't feel so impotent and frustrated that they can actually do something. And then I think people might start to get the idea that actually the power does reside with the people rather than the MPs, and there actually is some ultimate sanction that if they really behave badly, they can't just sit around trousering £65,000 a year for the next 2 or 3 years. They're out, and they, and we can kick them out. We need some mechanism.
No, absolutely, absolutely. We do need some mechanism. What it is, up for grabs, but there should. It is crazy that, for example, if Patrick Mercer hadn't resigned the whip, it's perfectly possible his local constituency could have reselected him, and he's in a safe enough seat that he'd probably be re-elected.
Yeah, and maybe if things had died down, yeah, I think that happened with the expenses scandal. I think it seemed a little bit arbitrary and random which MPs ended up being forced to stand down and which didn't. There were some MPs that seemed, on the face of it, to have done worse things than MPs who ended up getting forced to stand down by their leadership. I also felt that there was an element within the leadership, certainly of the Conservatives. I'm not really sure whether this happened in other parties, but some of the Conservative MPs who were forced to stand down, it felt to me like the Cameroons were taking their opportunity to get rid of people who they wanted to get rid of anyway. And yet there were others who they didn't want to get rid of, and so they didn't. And it was pretty arbitrary in that respect. Again, if you had some kind of recall mechanism, then it would hopefully be a bit less arbitrary. Although, who knows, the whim of the voter. But in the end, when you've got tens of thousands of people voting for something, that's got to be better than one party leader sitting in office with a couple of apparatchiks making these decisions, surely.
Well, yeah, one would assume so.
Okay. The other thing we did want to talk about was Ed Balls made a speech today in which he talked about universal benefits, specifically winter fuel payments, and that if Labour are in government after 2015, then they will legislate to make sure that the top 5% of pensioners, so pensioners who basically pay either the top rate of tax or the higher rate of tax, which I think is if they earn around 42,000, something like that, or higher, they won't get the winter fuel payment. They think this will save about £100 million a year. But there are various people on the left who are up in arms about this because it erodes the principle of universality, is the argument. Emma, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, we had a discussion on this a few weeks ago where I don't think the principle of universality, which people say is essential for people to buy into the welfare system. Well, people aren't buying into the welfare system. I mean, every polling you ever see tells us that. So I'm not convinced that that universality is doing the job that the left thinks it's doing.
Yeah.
In which case, it makes perfect sense to look at a system where, of means testing and better directing what limited money we have.
Mm.
My question then and my question now is, will it save money because means testing is complicated and expensive to do? Mm. So...
I mean, yeah, we did talk about the principle of this and we've talked about it at length. I'm actually a bit more interested in the politics of it this time round because of the fact that the statement's been made. So firstly, it is Labour starting to take what I would describe as difficult decisions. I know people have come in, Number 10 press office, for example, have come in and say that it's a drop in the ocean and it's pointless and all the rest of it. I disagree, actually. I think
it's signposting and it's good signposting. And actually, the more interesting part of the speech wasn't that just that announcement, but the nuanced way that he moved from here's what you do in the emergency time, a VAT cut and, you know, spending, to, OK, we're coming into the sluggish, really, really, really poor and slow recovery period, but we're not in the emergency time. So the VAT cut becomes less important, but it is more about investing in infrastructure projects.
Mm. But the thing I find frustrating about this kind of knee-jerk response of, well, it's a drop in the ocean, is you could say that about every single measure.
Yeah,
and actually that's what the government get frustrated with Labour for doing, is that Labour oppose all these cuts. And one of the things Labour often say about the individual cuts is, well, that only saves 16 million and that one only saves 50 million. But actually, when you add it all up, it's billions. And you know, this one is an example of, you have that one and then you have another 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 of these. And suddenly you're talking about big money because you have to save big money. And I think it's pretty clear that Ed Balls is now accepting that. He was talking about, although I found it quite interesting, the phraseology he used. He said, you know, we'll be in government at a time of falling spending. Didn't use the word cuts, falling spending, kind of passive term, you know, as if it's happening to the government rather than the government evilly doing it for ideological reasons. But I'll pass over that.
I think there is a difference, isn't there, in the relationship between conservatives and classic liberals and the state and Labour and the state. And then they're just different ways of looking at how you use and what size the state should be. So there are ideological reasons that conservatives would cut state spending above and beyond deficit reduction.
Possibly. I'm not here to defend the Conservative Party.
What about classic liberals?
I'm not really here to defend classic liberals either, because I have a bit of a pick and mix approach to policy in that respect. I'm not firmly on one wing of my party or the other, even if my party has wings, which I think a lot of people would dispute. Just in terms of come back to the politics, though, because I did think this was brave, not just because he's put a line in the sand and said that we're going to do this, but actually, old people vote. Aren't you a bit worried that this is the sort of thing that could actually cost Labour votes in significant marginal seats?
Not really. I think that the winter fuel allowance is... I think most people accept that if they get it, they should get it, and that the top 5% of pensioners probably shouldn't get it. And I think those top 5% who will lose it, A, if they're richer pensioners, they're more likely to be conservative anyway, and B, most of them are the ones who've been saying for... yonks, why am I entitled to this? It's ridiculous.
But it's one thing to, I mean, you're right, and I've been arguing this for ages. I mean, I was on Voice of Russia a few months ago and we had a debate specifically about this issue. You know, and I've been very clear that it is unsustainable. And I'm not surprised that Labour have done this. I think it's inevitable. You know, okay, so Cameron said before the last election that he's not going to touch those benefits, and he hasn't done. I'd be very surprised if in the next few years, whoever's in government next, don't do something about this, because it isn't fair. But you've got to see, you've only got to look at what happened with the whole granny tax thing, that it doesn't take much to whip up a storm about something emotive like this, because taking money away from old people, however you look at it, is emotive. And like I say, I hats off to Ed Balls and Ed Miliband, because I presume he must have sanctioned this.
Yeah.
You know, for doing this, and it perhaps says good things about what other brave measures they might be willing to countenance in the future. Now, one of the things I've criticised Labour for in the last few years is that I feel like they've been incredibly opportunistic and they've pretty much opposed everything the government's done. Well, now we're less than 2 years out from an election. I think they're doing what they need to do, which is they're actually setting out their stall, and they are risking pissing some people off, as I think they're going to have to do. If they're going to be a government, they will piss people off.
Yeah, absolutely. When we're in government, governments piss people off. That's kind of what their job is in many ways. It's who you piss off and why. And that's the political choices you make. I'm quite relaxed about this because I don't believe that the principle of universality has done what was claimed for it. There should be a universal safety net, but it's how that's managed and how that's run that is important.
Well, you'd be pleased to hear that Dan Hodges is cheering for this policy from the sidelines. So,
oh joy, me and Dan Hodges on the same side at last.
It had to happen eventually, Emma. You know, even a
stopped clock is wrong twice a day.
Exactly, yeah, or two stopped clocks that are just rotating next to each other randomly. Eventually, they'll be aligned at some point.
Eventually.
All right, okay. Well, like I said, it was a bit of a shorter one this week, so we're going to have to call time there. But thanks for your time tonight, Emma.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd also like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back next week.